You cannot be serious!
Don, not often do we have people back twice on You Cannot Be Serious, but we think if people are interesting, everyone's interesting, incidentally, that we interviewed, but we thought we'd have a recap on a, he's a man, he's a professor. I don't know if he's given himself that title or it was bestowed on him by his peers. Obviously it would be, but he can tell us that. I'll tell you who he is. His name is Professor Paul Taylor, and in case he doesn't know who he is, this is who he is. Paul Taylor is an accredited exercise physiologist and practicing nutritionist. He is the founder of Mind Body Brain Performance Institute, a former British Royal Navy aircrew officer. Paul is an exercise physiologist, nutritionist, and neuroscientist. That's who he is, Don. And he spoke about diet, wellness, health, overcoming pain, a whole lot of things. So what we might do, Paul, is welcome you to You Cannot Be Serious again, and maybe just give us a quick recap of what we spoke about the last time you were here and what's happened since. So welcome.
Thank you, Sam.
How'd I go?
Yeah, very good. And it's good to see that some things are consistent, because you were swearing at inanimate objects the last time I was here and you just did it again. So I'm loving that. And we'll just clear up the professor. I'm an ex-adjunct professor at University of San Francisco, but I think the last time I became an honorary professor of the You Cannot Be Serious podcast.
As I said last time, we're calling you a professor. We don't care if you're honorary or what you are. To us, you are a professor.
We'll go with that. So the last time, just for a quick recap, we talked about a number of things that are important, what I call hormetic stressors. So these are stressors that at low doses are beneficial for us, but at high doses can kill us. So we talked about the importance of exercise, and especially as you get older, because it prevents 26 of the most common chronic diseases. And then just a quick recap on recommendations. I think everybody over 40 should be doing strength training 2 to 3 times a week. Something called zone 5 exercises, which where you go hard and get your heart rate right up. Do that once to twice a week, depending on the time available. And then your zone 2 exercise, which is really good for your mitochondria and your cells. That's the traditional cardio. Do that kind of 20 to 30 minutes once or twice a week. And so, that kind of covers all bases on exercise.
So I would say, Don and Phoebe, that when you think that you should do exercise, people say, oh my God, I should be doing this for my health. How much exercise should just the rank and file in the community, unless you're training to do something specific like Don and I, who are over 70 and people who are... nor live a pretty sedentary life, just how hard and how much? I know you just said that then, but what do you mean by doing weight training and strength training to keep your bones and your muscles supple or at peak performance for your age?
So the reason why it's important is that contracting muscle creates these chemicals called myokines that get all the way through your body and improve every single organ and organ system, how they operate, protect them against disease, and actually protect your brain against disease. And one of the biggest drivers of chronic disease is because by the age of 75, it is pretty typical that you've lost 50% of your muscle mass from the peak in your 20s. So that means if we think of these myokines are like the ingredients of the medicine, you start off in your 20s with the highest dose of this medicine, and then by the time you're 75, you're on a half dose. And that's why it becomes important, particularly to do strength training as you get older, because it's those explosive, fast twitch fibers that we lose the quickest. They are the ones that enable you to put your foot out and recover your balance when you trip, or to stick your hand out and stop you from falling over. And we know that if you're age 65 and you fall over and you break a hip, you got a 50% chance of being dead within the next 5 years. It is the seventh biggest killer.
Really?
Seventh biggest killer of the 65-year-olds. And when you get to 75, it's the fifth biggest killer. So we need to preserve that muscle for that and overall general health for our bodies and for our brains, because it's really important for your brain.
Now, I'm playing devil's advocate. We die much later. In previous year, I believe people were fitter. They weren't overweight, going back 20, 40 years.
Yes.
Yet we are living longer, but we're overweight. So what's your answer to that?
The reason we're living longer is because of medicine. That is the reason we're living longer. And when you look at the ages and the life expectancy, they average it out across the whole population. So one of the biggest increases in life expectancy is because of improvements in infant mortality. So that's going to bump up the average age, right?
Infant mortality?
Yeah, infant mortality. So if lots of infants are dying,
I understand.
If they're dying, that reduces the life expectancy of the average population. Right. So when you look back at history, we're not actually, the people who live longest are not living any longer. It's just that the average person is living longer, or the average age is increasing. And that's because of sanitation, improvements in infant mortality, drug treatments for disease that keeps people alive for another 20 years. You know, you used to have a heart attack and that'd be it, you'd be gone pretty quickly. Now they put stents in and all of this. So we are living longer, despite our habits, and it's all because of medicine and sanitation that's helping us to live longer. Now, just on this, Don, our children are now the first generation that are predicted to live less, to live a shorter life than their parents. That's the first time in history that's happened. And that's
why do you say that, and why is it? Why are they saying? Why are you saying it? Why are they saying it?
Well, the data says this, and it's because of lifestyle practices and increased levels of obesity, diabetes, and all of these other.
Now, your book, Death by Comfort, and since I've been on this Be Fit food, it's protein based, and I'm finding I'm not eating as much. Now, it takes me back to when I was a kid. I'm certainly eating a lot more than I did, and my predecessor, my mother and father did. Are we just indulging more and we're not eating in the right way? Because people are overweight, and I went back in the 20s and 30s, and people weren't overweight back then.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see photographs of people 50s, 60s, they're not overweight. These are modern diseases, driven by modern day eating practices. And the big driver of it is what's called ultra processed foods. So these are foods that have large scale processing. Obvious things like sugary drinks, cakes, pastries, all of that. But things like breakfast cereals, supermarket breads, are actually quite damaging for us because of all of the additives that they have in it. And we eat far too much simple carbohydrates now and not enough protein.
Okay, that's what I was just going to... So we're eating too much because this BeFit food is protein, and I don't feel I need any more. That satisfies... For a small meal, that satisfies me till my next meal.
Yeah.
And so that's what I was going to ask. So we're eating too much carbohydrate.
Too much carbohydrate. And if you look at changes in dietary patterns in the 1970s and 80s when they brought in these bullshit recommendations to reduce fat, and it was based on dodgy research, but our carbohydrate content has gone through the roof. Now, I happen to know Kate from BeFit Food. She's great. Yeah. And the thing is, as you get older, your protein requirements go up, because your ability to break down and synthesize amino acids that are in protein reduces as you get older. So we actually have an increased requirement for protein as we get older to preserve our muscle, yet older people tend to eat less protein.
So with carbohydrate, does that make you eat more?
particularly ultra-processed food. So there's a beautiful randomized clinical trial done where they took a bunch of people, they put them on two different diets. So group A went on an ultra-processed food diet, group B went on a good food diet, right? Same amount of calories, fat, protein, and they said, you just eat how much you need to feel reasonably sated. And the group who were on the ultra-processed foods had 500 calories a day extra. What happens is these ultra-processed foods, they actually hijack our brain's reward systems and make us want to eat more. And because they're empty calories, we need more of them. And especially when you have lower protein. So that wasn't in this study. This study, the beauty of this study is group A went on the shit diet, group B were on the good food diet, and then they swapped over. So that's the beauty of a study like this. And in both cases, when they went on the ultra-processed food diet, 500 calories a day more. That explains that 500 calories a day is more than 10 kilos of weight gain in a year for the average person. That explains most of the chronic disease, the obesity and diabetes and all of these things.
So without living in a hermetically sealed environment,
yes,
that old slogan, everything is okay in moderation.
Absolutely.
Is it okay to drink alcohol, to, you've touched on the carbohydrates, to eat meat, to eat confectionery, to... I won't even bring the cigarettes up because that's no one would concede that. But what about fast foods? Is it okay occasionally without living and tormenting yourself just to get through to live to 100 without enjoying yourself? Is it okay to do any of that?
Yes, I have the 80-20 rule, right? So I talk about a low HI diet. A previous guest of yours, Dr. John Tickell, yep. I think he coined the phrase and I love it. HI stands for human interference. Basically, if you're looking at a food and you can see it's been alive recently, minimally interfered with, eat it. It's fine. Don't worry about the bloody fat, the carbs, the proteins. Yep. I think that goes with the 80-20 rule. About 80% of stuff that you eat should have been alive recently, stuff that your grandparents ate, and then your 20% is your treat food. So for some people, that's chocolate ice cream. For other people, it's burgers. And I say choose your 20%, but actually buy the best quality that you can buy. Of your 20%, right? And really enjoy your treats because we all need to live. And we know that when people are too restrictive, that that's actually not good for their mental health as well, right? So a little bit of alcohol. For me, it's alcohol, it's dark chocolate and cheesecake, right? So they're the three things that life would not be the same without. For other people, it could be fast food. It could be other things that they like. So choose your 20%, choose it wisely, and buy the best quality that you can afford for your treats.
So when you were an airman, air crew person,
yes,
person at the Royal Navy in the United Kingdom,
yes,
you studied, did you not, how to overcome pain and how to minimise the effect of trauma. How do you do that? And I know that, you have become an advocate for jumping into a bath full of ice and becoming an ice bath fanatic.
Yes.
Or have I got that out of...
No. So I went through combat survival and resistance to interrogation training, which was 10 days of pretty hardcore stuff that they're not allowed to do anymore. But it's basically what the military call stress inoculation training.
Hang on, you said they're not allowed to do it anymore.
They're not allowed to do it and to the levels that we did it.
Why?
Right, because of health and safety.
And Paul, was that with the British forces?
That was
forces?
With the British. But yeah. But there's now an inquiry going on about the Australians and some of the stuff that they did in a very similar
Can
course.
Can you explain what you go through?
So we had 10 days. We got thrashed physically every single day. We had no sleeping bags. It was the middle of winter. We had a waterproof bivy bag, but we were freezing.
A waterproof what?
A bivy bag, like Gore-Tex bag, that just kept us dry, but no heat. So we were massively sleep deprived for 10 days. We got hunted by a hunter force for 5 days. The only food we got in 10 days was a chicken between four people, and it was alive when we got it. And then at all the end of it, when we thought it was all over, we got introduced to the shock of capture, which is getting a bit of a kicking, dragged off to a place and interrogated for 12 hours. But
what, tortured?
Well, Waterboarded? Tortured is a heavy word. We were put in stress positions. You know, I remember the photos of Abu Ghraib back in Iraq where they were all in stress positions. And stress positions are horrible.
What are stress positions?
So it would be, for instance, standing with your hands up against the wall, a couple of paces from it, leaning against the wall and having to try to stand there for 20 minutes, right? Or sitting cross-legged with your hands behind your head and having to sit upright for 20 minutes, or lying down on the ground flat, straight, and being there for hours on end, right? So it's stuff that creates physical pain and discomfort and stress. And we were hooded. We had white noise playing at the volume you'd hear music in a nightclub. So all this sensory deprivation and sensory overload and physical stress to break you down mentally and emotionally.
So is the primary idea of that purely that if you're captured, you don't give up secrets?
Exactly. So that you, well, it's that you can resist interrogation as long as possible because information is very timely on the battlefield.
When can't
so,
you?
So, well, they realize you will break. Everybody is going to break, right?
Waterboarding?
But waterboarding will break people. Absolutely, waterboarding.
That's when they put a cloth over your face.
Yeah, and they
tip
water into your mouth. You on an angle and they tip it into your mouth and you feel like you're drowning and it's horrendous. Now, we didn't get waterboarded, but...
Why didn't you?
I think they viewed that as a bit extreme, right?
So that's what the enemy would do.
That's what the enemy would do, for sure. For sure. There's pretty horrible stuff. So, but this is stress inoculation training. So they inoculate us. It's like the vaccinations, right? I know it's a bit topical in here, but you get a dose of this so that you can respond to it better when it happens for real. So we're being inoculated against stress. And that's the premise of my book, is that we are avoiding stressors like exercise, cold exposure, heat exposure, hunger. These are stressors that actually make us stronger. And we are, modern life is not completely devoid of them, but we do it a lot less.
So what's the idea of getting into a bath full of ice?
So this is a bit of stress inoculation training, right? So all of these things, exercise, cold exposure, heat exposure, discomfort, actually enhances your ability to tolerate discomfort. And we see that people who have a wide range of psychological disorders often have low levels of discomfort tolerance, right? So the whole idea is that by deliberately exposing yourself to moderate amounts of stress, you train the stress response system. So you're an ex-elite athlete. When you went through training, the reason you got bigger, faster, stronger was because of the stress of the exercise. And then your body recovered,
yes,
and your muscles became bigger, faster, stronger. Without that stress stimulus, you don't become bigger, faster, stronger, right? So it's adaptation to stress. So what happens then is you're bigger, faster, stronger. But the research shows that you also enhance your ability to tolerate psychological stress if you undergo high intensity exercise, if you undergo cold exposure. So when you get in an ice bath, what happens is noradrenaline, which is the stress chemical, it's like the sister chemical of adrenaline in the body, it increases 300 to 500% within a minute, as does dopamine. Now, these are really important neurotransmitters in the brain for mood and for the ability to focus and for the ability to tolerate stress. So by just getting into that cold, you are actually training your stress response system globally, right? And actually very recent research showed that cold exposure has really beneficial effects on the brain, on connectivity between the front of the brain, which is called the frontal lobes,
yep,
and at the top near the back called the parietal lobe. And it increases that just being in an ice bath or cold water. In fact, this was 20 degree water I think it was 5 or 10 minutes that they were in it. And it actually, they did MRIs pre and post, and it showed increased connectivity between these two parts of the brain. Now, in depression, you get reduced connectivity between these two parts of the brain. We are seeing now that cold exposure is very helpful for people with depression and with anxiety, and we're now starting to see some of the reasons why. Because of these big increases in positive neurotransmitters and improved connectivity in parts of the brain that are normally dampened with mood disorders.
Is this a fad at the moment? Because down my way, I live on the peninsula, a lot of people are swimming in the bay 365 days of the year. It seems to be a fad that's only just come in the last 12 months.
Yeah, I don't think it's a fad. I was doing it in lockdown. And out there in the bay in winter. And the reason why, and in the UK, this has gone off.
What do you mean off?
Over lockdown. It's gone crazy. I interviewed Professor Mike Tipton on my podcast, who's one of the world leaders in cold exposure. And he said there was a few hundred people who would do cold water swimming around the UK all year round. And in lockdown, there were thousands of them. And they have actually surveyed the people, and a lot of them are saying they're having improvements in their depression or complete resolution of their depression, improvements in anxiety. They feel much better. And it's because when you expose yourself to cold, your body ramps up. It has a whole body-brain response to the cold that increases these chemicals around motivation and alertness, basically to say, get the hell out of the bloody water. But they have a residual spillover effect that lasts for hours. And that's why people, and I'm one of these people who do it and doing regular cold showers, it improves your mood.
Okay, but Paul, wouldn't it be through exercise you're stimulating all these endorphins and whatever else? So yes, you don't have to go swimming or get yourself in a bath, but if you did some type of physical activity, you get this high, which helps you with your depression and whatever else. In other words, exercise is addictive.
Yeah, and it's one of those positive addictions. And I always say to people with exercise, don't exercise because you don't want to get heart disease or stuff like that. Think about how it makes you feel. Right?
But that only lasts for half an hour after exercise, doesn't it? That high that you get after exercise.
Oh, I would say that the research is saying there are long-term changes in the brain. There are chemicals such as BDNF that are released in the brain that help you grow new brain cells and protect those brain cells and help with connections of those brain cells, help with learning and memory, and a whole host of mood-enhancing chemicals that actually persist. And there are changes in gene expression from exercise that last for more than 24 hours. So if you're doing it, that my take for people, don't do it twice a week, 1 hour. Do a short bit of exercise every single day.
So, Professor Paul Taylor, if I could ask you about Fiona Byrne, who I've got a feeling, I'm just stand corrected.
Oh, my God, yes.
No, I'm not sure you do a lot of physical exercise.
She's a walker.
I just said I'm not sure if she does a lot of physical exercise, but she would represent 90% of the community. What possible advantage would Fiona Byrne get out of getting into an ice bath and then getting into a hot room or a sauna and then getting back into the ice bath? Is this take the place of doing actual physical exercise?
Okay, Paul, could I just jump in here?
Sure.
I would just like to own this statement of Sam's. I am not an elite athlete. I am what you would call a plus size model, and I don't even run for trams. So I'm happy to be, I'm happy to be old and quite fat. So female. So if you could give an answer to what I would say, I'm a fairly average person. If we could address the
exactly
answer to the
I
average
said.
Person.
Yeah. So
and also actually, can I jump in there? The starting point, because one of the things I find with a lot of conversations about exercise, and I hope you know people who are listening sort of don't mind me just generalizing here, it's easy to hear what we should be doing. But the challenge is getting started.
Absolutely.
And a lot of podcasts, a lot of experts, they were talking about this, that and the other. Most people just need a pretty basic starting point, because that's the challenge. Getting started is the challenge.
Yeah. So, and it's a great point. And Fiona, you do represent most of the population. We know that most of the adult population does not meet the minimum activity guidelines, right? So what I would say, and I would be sitting down with Fiona, and part of my behavior change model, which we can talk about in full, I talk about the easier model. That's a mnemonic. The E stands for explore your reasons why it's important, right? Anthony Robbins says, find your why, you'll find your way. He stole it from the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who said, he who has a why to live can bear almost any how. So it's about sitting down and going, okay, let's explore why exercise could be important for you. So it's really about, how do you want to live your last 10 years of your life, right? Also about your energy levels right now, vitality, right? And brain function. I'm sure cognitive function is really important for you. So I will be sitting down and explaining all the benefits of exercise for cognitive function, exploring your values, right? And what's important to you. And then linking that to exercise and all of the benefits that you're going to get for your physical and your mental health, both now and in the future. And then we'd be saying, okay, so what do you do now? And you say you go for a walk. And I'd be saying, okay, maybe for the next month, we do a little experiment and you go out for a walk, whether it's after dinner, but you're going to do a couple of Ks of a walk, but lampposts are key. So between the first two lampposts, you're going to walk normally. Between the second two lampposts, you're going to walk as fast as you possibly can. Then you're going to walk normally. Then you're going to walk fast, right? And for the first week or two, if you're not, and maybe somebody who's even less active than you, they will be blowing out their arse doing that, right? That will be hard, yeah. Right? Particularly the first few sessions. But after a month, you're going to come to me and go, Paul, that was really hard at the start. Now, I'm actually finding it quite easy. And I'm going to go, awesome. For the next month, we're going to do walk between the first two lampposts, and then you're going to do the Fiona shuffle, right? So you're going to break into a kind of a quasi jog for those next two. And the same thing, the first couple is going to be hard, then it's going to get easier. And that fact that it's getting easier is going to build self-efficacy in your brain, the belief that what I'm doing is making a difference. You're going to start to feel some of those benefits. And then you might come to me and go, okay, I'm in, what else now? And then I'm going to say, we need to start lifting some heavy shit, Fiona, because osteoporosis is a bitch, particularly for older females, and we don't want that, do we? And we'd have a discussion about that. You'd probably agree. And then I'd bring you into the gym and teach you how to lift weights. And we'd start off light, but you would be getting stronger. And as you're getting stronger, you're going, this is friggin' awesome. And then after a while, chances are you're going to turn into a bloody warrior.
So the keys are... start, be realistic. It's a long journey. It's not a short.
Yes.
It's not. You're not going to achieve your goals or solve your problems in 12 weeks. It is a long journey. It's correct. About consistency and commitment, by the sounds of it.
That's right.
A little bit, a lot. Thank you, Sam. You should trademark that, Sam. That's a good.
Also, framing it that exercise is not about weight loss. Diet is how you lose weight. Exercise is not that effective for weight loss. Now, with diet, it can increase the effectiveness, but it's really about your ecosystem of cells in your body and your brain, right? And it is about building up, and it's meeting the individual where they're at. And I would be saying to you, the research shows that the people who have the lowest amount of cardiovascular fitness, if you can increase their fitness to below average, which we could easily do with you, say you were really unfit, right? I would imagine you're not low, but let's presume you were in the lowest category. To get you to below average, you would have a reduced risk of death in the next 15 years of 95% compared to people who remain at the lowest fitness category.
Can I just say, I'm enjoying the fact that Sam is sitting here, clearly quite happy that he's saving my life. So thank you, Sam.
Well, but Paul, there's nothing new in what you're saying. Now, you said about gradual increase, you know, start walking. Cooper advocated this in his book called Aerobics. Now, when we first got introduced to sauna here in Australia, there were plunge pools. We get in the sauna and then jump into the plunge pool. I don't know what for, but it was a Scandinavian thing.
Yeah.
So there's nothing new in this, is there?
Well, there has been... isolated people doing that. So the Finns have done that for a long period of time. I think it's new for a lot of Australians. And the benefits of going from heat to cold, when you're hot, your whole cardiovascular system opens up. You get vasodilation, as it's called, right? Your arteries and veins, they open up.
Yeah.
And then when you jump into the cold,
vasoconstriction.
Yeah. So it's actually exercising your cardiovascular system really well. Now, for any listeners, if you have not done this before, and particularly if you're
wouldn't
older...
Wouldn't that put more heart strain on your heart?
Exactly. That's why I'm saying, if you're a listener, you have not done this before, don't jump straight into, oh, I'm going to do a sauna, into an ice bath, right? So you should have people around you when you do it. Do the sauna first. Do a cold shower first, build up your tolerance, and then after a while, so I do that protocol in winter, I'm in the sauna, then I jump into a freezing cold swimming pool, and then back in, right? So after you've done it for a while, you adapt to that, and it's just that overload training that we're talking about, right? This is the equivalent of a marathon run or doing powerlifting. You wouldn't start there. You start with and getting into the sauna for 10, 15 minutes, having a 30-second cold shower, and then you progressively overload, just like you do with exercise, right? So that's the thing. You need to progressively overload the system. I think what is quite new these days is the importance of strength training and how your muscle strength right now is very predictive of longevity. Like extremely predictive of longevity. So the stronger you can get going into older age, the better. But
so hang on, you're talking about weights. Is that for the bone or for the muscle?
Both.
Both.
And the brain and your organs, right? Because when you are doing strength training, you're releasing these myokines that is basically medicine for every organ and organ system in your body. And your brain as well. It's important for mood, for motivation, for focused attention, for overall cognitive function, and the function of all of your organs and your muscles and your bones. And so it is just the best medicine that you can possibly get.
So I would say the thing that bedevils us all is sleep deprivation. And of course, they say the best remedy for insomnia,
yes,
is to get some sleep.
Yeah,
so how do we improve our sleeping patterns so that we're not stressed and toss and turn when we, yep, go to bed? I reckon everyone suffers from that. Most of the people I speak to do anyhow.
Yeah, so if I can take one step back and say why sleep's important, right? When you're asleep, your brain repairs itself and your body repairs itself. Your DNA repair enzymes switch on. So there's a clock in your brain called a suprachiasmatic nucleus that when you're asleep, that clock switches on a whole host of bodily and brain repair mechanisms. Now, most people are not aware of this. In the body, the body gets rid of waste products, right? From just the cells, all your cells using oxygen creates waste products. And other cellular processes create waste products, and we use our lymphatic system to get rid of that, right? The brain doesn't have a lymphatic system. So researchers for decades were just completely confused. How does the brain get rid of waste? Because neurons produce waste by aerobic metabolism. Some genius injected a radioactive tracer into brains and looked imaging when they were asleep. They did it in animals first and then in humans, and they found that your cardiovascular system in your brain is different to the one in your body.
Hang on, the
cardiovascular system
in your brain.
Yes, so when I say cardiovascular system, that's your heart, your arteries, your veins, right? So you've got arteries and veins in your brain that bring blood in and take it back out.
Yeah.
And in the rest, in the body, that's a one-way highway. The blood flows inside those veins and arteries.
Yeah.
In the brain, at night, your brain cells shrink. They dump their waste products into this extracellular matrix, and those waste products get to the outside of your cardiovascular system, and it's a two-way highway in your brain. Blood flows in and waste products flow out. Now that is frigging amazing, right? And it comes to the nearest lymph node in your neck and dumps all of its waste products.
So what about the artificial aids that get you to sleep, like sleeping tablets? And yeah. Is that deleterious to your health, or should you try and just for most of the time just try and go to sleep naturally?
Sleeping tablets are not good, and particularly in the long term. They were never meant to be long term. It's actually not the same brainwave patterns as normal sleep. Right. So and it's been shown to be disruptive in the long term. So I'm going to give you some sleep hygiene tips, and then we'll maybe talk about some supplements that people could use yep. if they really struggle. So I've got a number of things. And by the way, just for to round this out, people who have chronically poor sleep live shorter lives, have a significantly increased risk of Alzheimer's, other forms of dementia, heart disease, obesity, diabetes, certain forms of cancer, poor performance. And for the gentlemen who are listening, after about 2 to 3 nights of bad sleep, your balls shrink.
My God.
Yeah, that's my problem.
Yeah, that's right. We haven't got any.
And your testosterone is...
We are eunuchs. Professor, what is the ideal amount of... I know, just... realistically, the ideal amount of sleep someone should have?
Yeah, look it changes for age group. Young kids obviously need more. For adults, 7 to 8 hours, right? Some people can get away with a little bit less. And as you're older, generally people have a little bit less sleep, right? That does not to mean that they need less sleep. But for me, the 7-hour rule, right? Different people have different recommendations, but for me, you should be aiming for 7 hours of sleep a night, right?
So, but isn't sleep a habit?
I would say the practices, the sleep hygiene practices are a habit. Sleep is a result of those practices that you do.
Give us a quick rundown of sleep hygiene tips, yep. because that's actually a really interesting topic.
Yeah. So one is caffeine. So for me, caffeine is actually a brain stimulant. Mm. They give it to fighter pilots in times of war to keep them awake, right? It has a half-life of about 6 hours. That means for the average person, you drink a cup of coffee, 6 hours later, half of it's still in your system. So a quick version of this, 250/8. No more than 250 milligrams, which is about 3 cups of coffee throughout the day, and try to be done 8 hours before you go to bed, minimum. Right, so generally noon, 2 o'clock, kill the caffeine. Now remember, it's not only coffee, it's tea, energy drinks, diet drinks, chocolate, all have significant amounts of caffeine in them. So that's one. The other one is alcohol. What we know is caffeine inhibits stage 4. So even if you can get to sleep, and there'll be people listening to this going, I can have an espresso and go straight to sleep. Yes, you can, but your time you spend in deep sleep, stage 4, where all the repair happens, is reduced if you're drinking caffeine, right? Alcohol inhibits REM sleep, rapid eye movement, which is dream sleep. So Dutch researchers showed that if you minimize dream sleep, people get anxiety. This is the only time in your life that the brain blocks stress hormones. Because what happens when you're dreaming, you're replaying the day's events over in your brain, and it's deciding what to store as a memory. And yeah. So if you remember that stressful thing that happened that day, so Sam, you're remembering your interaction with the computer, it's going to wake you up and go, Jesus, what are you doing asleep? So it blocks stress hormone. And what that does is it's like therapy for the brain.
So I'm just reminded why we've had you on twice. Might get you on every other week because this is fascinating. So please don't think I'm being provocative or stupid.
Yes.
But... so you mentioned the fighter pilots take caffeine. Would the next level be taking cocaine? And what about mushrooms? They say mushrooms now send you into a psychedelic pitch and can give you a whole new look on life when you're under the influence of them, or are we starting to just be ridiculous?
Well, we're getting into psychostimulants.
I'm not advocating any of that.
No, but we're getting into the world of psychostimulants. So caffeine is a psychostimulant. Alcohol is a psychostimulant, so is mushrooms, so is ketamine, so is cocaine, so of all of these drugs. They are psychostimulants, so they change the way that your brain perceives reality. Caffeine just happens to be the most widely used psychostimulant, legal psychostimulant yep. in the world. and followed by alcohol, right? So, and that, look, that whole thing is probably a conversation for another podcast, because there are apparent therapeutic uses of some of those psychostimulants for people with PTSD. But again, another conversation. So if we want to come back to sleep, finish off the sleep hygiene.
Yes.
Routine is really important. This is how most of us screw up our sleep, because we go to bed at different times and we wake up at different times. That changes your circadian rhythm, right? So the brain gets confused. We want a regular circadian rhythm, and sleep psychologists will say this is the most important thing. To try to wake, even more important than going to bed at the same time, is waking up at the same time, even on weekends.
What about a nana nap during the afternoon?
There are a huge amounts of emerging benefits about having a short nana nap. The research would say try not to do it after 3 p.m. and try to keep it in that 20 to 40 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
And it can be really beneficial for you, particularly as you get a little bit older, right? So that's one thing. So I talked about the routine is really important. Then your brain needs to wind down. So a couple of things that are really important here is not having bright lights on at night, because they will inhibit the production of melatonin, the sleep hormone.
Hang on, what, before you go to bed?
Before you go to bed, yeah. So dim all of your lights, and ideally at least a half an hour without exposure to blue light. So we get blue light from televisions, from laptops, from mobile phones.
Oh, shit.
So try to have half an hour without that exposure. And this is where you do a wind down routine, right? You can do some breath work, which we can talk about breath work. You can do some, it doesn't matter, whatever's relaxing, knitting, drawing, writing, journaling, brilliant thing to do. And have that half an hour where you just don't have lots of inputs into the brain so that you can decompress, right? And then another thing that's really important, early morning sunlight. Early morning sunlight resets the circadian rhythm. And I always say to people, try to get out into the sun for at least 2 minutes if it's a bright day. If it's a dull day, 8 minutes, especially before you have your first cup of caffeine. Because caffeine will compete for docking on the adenosine receptor, right? So we want that natural sunlight first thing in the morning is really, really critical.
So that means sleeping with your blinds up?
Or just get out of the house and go for a walk. First thing in the morning. Now, if you're outside, it's about 50 times more effective than if you're inside through a window, right? So we want to get out and get... It's those yellowy rays when the sun is rising and setting that resets our circadian rhythms, not the bright middle of the day. So early morning light is really, really key. And then another thing, your bedroom needs to be a sleep sanctuary. It's where you go to sleep. And if you're lucky, you get a bit of oofty magoofty every now and then, right?
Oofty what?
Oofty magoofty.
Choking the chicken, Don. We did that in one of the segments. They said you should choke the chicken 21 times.
That's every day.
A month.
5 days a week.
It saves prostate, but we haven't got a prostate. We obviously haven't choked the chicken. You're talking about breaths, which reminds me of the Benny Hill pretending he's a doctor, had this young girl in the chair and he said, big breaths. And she said, yes, and I'm only 16. I'm calling you a doctor, professor. You've got a book out called Death by Comfort, How Modern Life is Killing Us and What We Can Do About It. It's available everywhere. And we would suggest, would we not, Don and Fiona, that if you want to just recap on everything that, and maybe a little more than Professor Paul Taylor has said, Death by Comfort is a... vital compendium to have in your bookshelf, Don. You got anything else you'd like to ask the doc that might be sensible?
Well, I just think it's a very apt title because I, as I said to you, I went back, I look at old photographs, I look at the way people used to live, and I think we've become a very sedentary society. Mm. I mean, it was very manually orientated. You know, we had a lot of people worked on farms in the old days.
Yep.
And yet their physiques were fantastic. They weren't overweight.
Mm.
But I just think society's become very, very decadent. And well, I look and I sit and have coffees and I just do not understand, you know, the big heifers that walk by in their tights and whatever
that's
else.
Men and women.
That's basically everyone. Women.
Thank you, Don. I'm trying to tidy this up so that we don't embarrass Paul. Everyone who is overweight and in tights can be men and women and anyone else that likes to signal that they're anything else. So, Don, I'm sure we had great reaction to Paul Taylor the last time and I'm sure we'll have it again. So thank you very much for coming in and being part of
My pleasure.
You Cannot Be Serious. Professor, what? Go on.
Jeez. I'm going to ask him off air.
We'll ask him on air.
Okay, Fiona's sitting here on the right and she wrote a story and this fascinates me. You're talking about the cold bar, so... John Van Wees is going to swim in the Loch Ness Channel.
Yep.
And is there a difference in the temperature in Loch Ness Channel in comparison to, say, swimming in the bay? He's doing ice baths and whatever else. Is he going to make it? And how challenging will this be adapting to the cold? Is it colder at Loch Ness?
It is colder at Loch Ness. Having lived in Scotland, I can tell you it is colder at Loch Ness, significantly colder than it is in the bay in winter. He's doing all the right things. And I know John Van Wees, he's a legend, as is his sister Tammy, who also swam in Loch Ness. But that cold adaptation process is really, really important. What happens is the more often you get into cold, you do develop that tolerance for cold. So John is doing absolutely the right training. And knowing John, there's not many people with more mental strength than he has.
No.
And that's because he's had a lifetime of stress inoculation training. Right, this shit doesn't happen by accident. And maybe for my closing statement, I'll close with the words of Epictetus, the Stoic philosopher, who said a couple of thousand years ago that we should all undergo a hard winter's training and not enter in lightly in for things for which we have not prepared. And he was talking about life. And I think we need more stress inoculation training, starting with our kids. Rather than pampering and mollycoddling them, we need to be doing more exercise, we need to be teaching them stress management skills, and we need to be exposing them to moderate amounts of stress so that they can build up a tolerance.
On the off chance that Don won't interrupt Fiona Byrne, I'm going to get her to close this off.
Well, thank you, Sam. Paul, thank you for joining us. Fantastic conversation, lots to take away, and a great book to read, Death by Comfort by Paul Taylor.
Thank you. And if anybody's interested, I also have a podcast called The Mind, Body, Brain Project.
I'm open around the streets late at night. I'm worried because